Now, with that out of the way, I will turn it over to today's moderator, Eric Prasad. Eric is a health specialist with NIEHS's Worker Training Program within the Division of Extramural Research and Training. Eric, without further ado, I yield the floor to you.
Thank you, Dylan. And it's a pleasure to be here. Good morning, good afternoon. It's one of those funny times where, depending on the coast, which you are, I'd like to say how great it is to be able to join today's webinar. I work with the NIHS and specifically with the Worker Training and Education Program, where we focus on providing leadership and funding to hazmat delivery of training and education around the country, including emergency response, and have a well-respected job training program for disadvantaged communities, those that are disadvantaged by environmental contamination and lack of training. We also have our own SBIR program, which works to develop hazmat program training and education, and has been doing that for many years. And you will actually have an opportunity to hear from one of our grantees, Cesar Bandera, who runs the organization Cell Podium, in the third of the series that is being presented here today. So this is the second of three. The next one is on May 17th. Cell Podium will talk about, the products and services that they've done to aid public health and responder training, along with some phenomenal panelists as well. More information and links to register will be available in the chat and shared again at the end of the presentation. But for the people that you're actually here to see, I want to introduce Dr. Rachel Jones. It is my pleasure to introduce her, and we will begin with the interdisciplinary training, education, and research activities for assessing and controlling contaminants from emerging technologies, or INTERACT program, a collaboration between the University of Minnesota, University of Iowa, and the University of Utah. We are joined by Dr. Rachel Jones, formerly with the University of Utah, now a professor and chairwoman of the Department of Environmental Health at the University of California, Los Angeles Fields School of Public Health. So, Dr. Jones, I turn it over to you.
Right. Thank you very much for the introduction, and let me get my presentation squared away. All right. I'm really pleased to be presenting here today on behalf of my partners in the INTERACT project. This project is funded by NIEHS and R25 ES033035. The project involves a team of collaborators led by Dr. Susan Arnold at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. And you can see our co-investigators and project staff listed here. We also have representations from the University of Iowa School of Public Health. And as mentioned, I'm currently at UCLA, but when the project was initiated, I was at the University of Utah. The goals of our project are to build an occupational safety and health workforce capable of anticipating and preventing hazards from emerging technologies. And we have three specific aims that we're pursuing. One is to develop three core courses that build cross-cutting skills. And those courses are chemical hazard recognition, exposure assessment, and cumulative risk assessment. And these courses will also be integrated with case studies that demonstrate their applications to emerging technologies. Our second aim is to provide research experience for graduate students to apply recognition and risk assessment skills to emerging technologies. And I'll talk about how we have done this, but we're also transitioning to offering a new week-long summer intensive program for undergraduate students, which I'll discuss more in a few minutes. And then a third is related to dissemination, and that is to integrate our new course content into ongoing academic curricula and continuing education professional development courses. The scope of this work includes a target audience that's relatively diverse but is focused on occupational hygiene application learners. And they will include students in industrial hygiene academic programs, adult learners who may be in allied fields and seeking some more background training related to industrial hygiene, as well as for practicing industrial hygienists who may be seeking review of basic concepts or looking for technology-specific information. The technologies that we're focused on and that are integrated through the case studies are additive manufacturing, nanomaterials, and novel drug delivery, sorry. The INTERACT project actually builds on a prior grant from NIEHS that was made to the University of Minnesota and the University of Iowa, as well as Dakota County Technical College. And Pete Rayner and Tom Peters from the METFAST project have been involved in the conceptualization and day-to-day operations of INTERACT. This program created a course that was in Introduction to Occupational Hygiene, as well as a course about nanotechnology, health, and safety. And these course materials are still available on their YouTube channel and have been viewed thousands of times. For our course design, we are leveraging the experience from METFAST to develop a process for course development and review. And we start out with the primary author or authors of each of the course modules developing a narrative outline, and then we perform peer review on the technical components of it. From that point, the author then develops the narrative more fully, as well as the slides that would accompany the course. Then animations and graphics are added to the slides. And then there's a review both by an instructional designer and by peers to look at the course material, both from a technical content, but also from an educational perspective. Then the content is revised once again, taking that feedback into consideration. It's recorded and then edited to assemble the final product. So as we've worked through this course development and design strategy, we have deliberately incorporated multiple opportunities for review and revision. I think it's a strength that we've integrated an instructional designer into the process. And we've also emphasized in the course materials accessibility. The first course that we have worked on and is now completed and available on the INTERACT website and our YouTube channel is about chemical hazard recognition. And it involves 12 modules, which each module is from 15 to 30 minutes long. These are the learning outcomes associated with this particular course. And so you can see it covers the basic principles and practices in industrial hygiene related to identification of hazards, visualization of information, determinants of exposure, properties of chemicals and their impact on human health, and the logic about how data collection is performed to support different types of industrial hygiene goals. As I mentioned, we have two ways that the courses are disseminated. The first is through our YouTube channel, where learners can access the recordings. And they're also hosted at the University of Minnesota Exposure Science and Sustainability Institute website, where learners can access the recordings, copies of the slides, as well as transcripts. So these would be the narrative transcripts that include descriptions of the graphics for those with low visibility or low vision. I just wanted to give you a few examples of some of the types of materials that we present and what some of it looks like. This image here is taken from a slide developed by Rebecca Burton and Susan Arnold. That's part of our case study for additive manufacturing. And this is part of a series of slides where they describe the actual mechanical process in this particular additive manufacturing. And so we have incorporated graphics as well as text with an emphasis on limited text in the actual slides, but it's supported by a narrative description by Dr. Arnold. We also use different types of graphics and and dynamic slides to go through different kinds of lists. This is an example of a slide taken from a module that I created about organizations that establish occupational exposure limits. And I'm showing this here to highlight that as each organization is discussed in the narrative, the slide advances to make that one bold and the other ones go into the background. This is an example here of the narrative that accompanies the slides, so that for people who prefer to read rather than listen, they can have access to the information. We also have animations that are created by Derek Siebert with University of Iowa. And I would suggest that you go to YouTube to watch this. There's an animation that starts at 1 minute and 45 seconds. And I would show that, but in our tech run through, I failed. So we will I will let you view that on your own time. So to date, for AIM 1, we have 18 modules that are available that relate to the chemical hazard recognition course, as well as some of the case studies. Right now, most viewed module is titled Using the Structure Determinants STIC module to conduct a preliminary exposure assessment, which had 249 views as of April 15th. These modules have all been posted over the course of the winter, so some of them only have been available for a month or two. So we're hoping that as the spring and summer progresses, we'll have increased views. In terms of progress, we have templates for the slides that have been developed that I'm using here for this presentation, and we have a workflow that's been developed for the modules creation, which I described. And I would say that one of the big takeaways for me is that I've learned a lot from working with the instructional designer about how to assemble and plan online educational activities that are asynchronous. And I feel that that's a shared benefit for the participants in the Interact program, in that we have learned a lot ourselves about how to develop and deliver such materials. The next steps that we're working on with respect to AIM 1 is the implementation of the exposure assessment course that has been planned, and the learning outcomes developed for each of the modules. And the majority of the modules are in the development process where the authors are writing the narratives and starting to assemble the slides. We also have some initial plans for the risk assessment course, the cumulative risk assessment course, which we expect to move into implementation next year. AIM 2 involved creating research experiences for graduate students. So to date, two PhD students at the University of Minnesota have received support related to this. Both of them have conducted research experiences that are directly related to the themes of Interact. One project I show here was recently published by Poulenc Mochel, comparing Antoine parameter sources for accurate vapor pressure prediction across a range of temperatures. And then we have another paper about risk assessment methods, which are used in industrial hygiene research, which was a review study, and that has been submitted for publication. So we're very proud of the students who've been working on this project, and they've worked very hard and learned a lot and contributed to the goals of Interact, but also to our own experience doing research and mentoring. AIM 2 is transitioning to a summer program. And the reason that we're doing this is that we have a real interest in trying to increase recruitment into industrial hygiene programs. And it seemed like a good opportunity to tap into the kind of strength that each of our universities has with creating undergraduate research opportunities. So this first trial event will be a 1 week summer experiential learning opportunity. It's going to be the first week of June at the University of Minnesota. Students who participate will receive a stipend, and we are considering providing some travel support to students who are coming from outside Minnesota. The course is going to feature hands-on activities in the laboratory, field trips, opportunities to meet with graduate students and professionals working in industrial hygiene, opportunities to learn about graduate school and how to apply to graduate school, as well as some activities related to leadership training. And so I'm quite excited to be participating in this. And most will have a faculty coming from, of course, Minnesota. I will be coming to teach, to support 2 days of the activities. And we have some individuals coming from Iowa as well to support this. So we're really excited about the opportunity to recruit talented STEM students into industrial hygiene. AIM 3 is really, as I mentioned, about extending the reach of our programs. And so we're doing this through two ways. One is continuing education. So currently, we've identified the structured deterministic module and the module about data and similar exposure groups from our online courses that we will adapt into continuing education courses. So those will have a slightly different structure, but cover some similar material and be available for formal continuing education credit. Then part of the reason that we envisioned and developed the online modules was for use in the academic programs, primarily in a flipped classroom instructional approach, with the idea that they can supplement activities in class and reduce the amount of time spent in class on lectures and more so that there's more time available for students to work on actual problems and be engaged in discussion with faculty and other students. So there are plans. Some of this has been implemented at the University of Minnesota, and we're working on plans to implement some of this at both Iowa and UCLA. And our hope is that this can be promoted to other institutions and taken up to supplement their curricular activities. We have been evaluating progress from and the experience of participating in Interact. And I think from our evaluation, we find some strengths related to positive team dynamics of the investigator team, that there's been useful learning opportunities for the team to improve their own instructional methods and knowledge. And that as a group, we've been able to acknowledge the challenges that we have working together doing this complex activity. But and through that acknowledgement, we've been able to improve performance of our over time. Some areas that had been identified in evaluation for improvement are some clarifications of roles and priorities, some checklists for tasks and how we hand off work that's being reviewed or transitioned from faculty to or from the investigators to the instructional designers and back and forth. And we've also done a few things to modify our meeting schedule and agendas to make those efforts more impactful. I would say that the biggest challenge that we faced as a group was trying to develop a workflow and a technology system for the instructors and the instructional designer that met everybody's needs. Our team came to this project with varied levels of experience with developing online educational knowledge, and everybody had used different technologies and had different practices and approaches for creating content. And so it took us quite a while to develop a shared understanding of a workflow and technology system. But I think that we did achieve it. And so we expect that the exposure assessment course modules will be much more straightforward for the development process. So I just want to highlight again here the INTERACT is an acronym for Interdisciplinary Training, Education, and Research Activities for Assessing and Controlling Contaminants from Emerging Technologies. I'm happy to take any questions.
Hey everybody, that was a wonderful presentation, Dr. Jones, and it was also exciting to see Pete Rayner as on the slides. He's one of our grantees,
Yes.
so I was like, oh shoot, he can't even run away from me. I had just seen him yesterday and everything, so it was great. I'm going to take a point of privilege and ask a question first while the folks put questions in the Q&A pod. If others want to use the modules for education and training, should they contact Interact? And are there any restrictions on accessing or using these materials?
Yeah, no, all of the materials are available and free to use. We would recommend that you just link to them through the YouTube channel for whatever course syllabi or activities that, to direct the students there. There has been some issues associated with maintenance of intellectual property with the MetFast modules, where it has been identified that people had been taking the content and rebranding it. So we ask that you not rebrand the content, but you're more than welcome to use the content as is from the public dissemination platforms. And certainly, if you have questions about any of the material or seeking advice on how to use it in your classrooms, we're more than happy to speak with you about that.
I am muted. I have a question from someone in the audience. Are the courses for the students who are receiving their graduate credits are open to outsiders who are not expecting any course credits? Did those courses follow the OSHA's guidelines and regulations? How are those courses different from the OSHA's 40-hour HAZWOP training course?
Okay. Yeah. So all of the materials that we have produced to date are just available on the YouTube channel or the University of Minnesota site. So you can view them and you would not receive any graduate credit for that. However, instructors at universities may elect to use some of that material as part of a graduate course that's being offered or an undergraduate course, and that students at that institution who take the course receive credit for it. But just as we have offering the material, just as we have the material available publicly, that does not come with academic credit. We didn't design the course to specifically meet or align with any requirements from OSHA because we envisioned them really as part of academic training. And so they are focused on basic principles about industrial hygiene, particularly the chemical hazard recognition course. And so we think that they're pretty accessible to a wide audience in that there's not an assumption of a lot of basic knowledge for learners before that they take that course. But it is quite different than the HAZWOP training courses.
Yeah, thank you for that. And just in case I don't see any more open questions, but I do have a few more. How do the investigators, envision incorporating the modules into academic programs? And do you have any examples of successes with this? Because, we love to hear good stuff.
Yeah, so I know that Dr. Arnold has been particularly engaged in incorporating the content into her courses that she teaches at the University of Minnesota. And her approach has been to use what's called a flipped classroom design so that the courses serve as the equivalent of her lectures that so instead of her standing in front of the class and giving the lectures to them, the students can engage with the material on their own time outside of class. So that when she comes to the classroom with the students, she's able to give a review of concepts that were covered in the modules, answer any technical questions, and then move on to activities that provide more opportunity for the students to engage directly with her and with the material. So, problem solving and group-based learning activities. So, the hope is that we can get other faculty members at the co-investigator institutions or other institutions to start integrating this material because many of us at the different academic programs have a lot of overlapping content and a lot of the more introductory content is quite consistent between the academic programs. Another place that I think that the modules have a role in academic programs is as kind of a introductory material for students who may have less background in some of the chemical or physical concepts, and so that they can start to study that material before they matriculate or as a review before they go on to a higher level class.
I'm also wondering, do you perhaps, are there any recommendations or lessons learned from the process of developing the first course that are being
Yeah.
employed in subsequent courses that you might want to share about?
Yeah, so one thing especially was the workflow process that we had to work through developing together. As I had mentioned, Pete Rayner, for example, and Tom Peters had a lot of experience with online course development through the MetFast program. And I would say that I was brand new to this experience. And so we had a lot of time, we spent a lot of time as a group trying to understand how people think about their educational course design, and what are the technologies that they are comfortable with and have access to at their different institutions to enable the course design. So, for example, universities subscribe to different types of instructional software and other kinds of resources. So that actually can be a big barrier to inter-institutional collaboration, is simply that one campus has a certain brand of software used for recording video, which is different and not necessarily very compatible with the product that's purchased at another campus. So we spent quite a bit of time discussing those details and thinking through what technologies that we could use that were low cost and accessible, and user-friendly, that would be meet the needs of all the different instructors. So we're using that now. So hopefully things will go a lot smoother as we move forward to develop the other courses.
Yeah, well, I think things go smoother when you get people with that subject matter expertise. You're working in this collaborative process. You're not siloed like in the ivory tower mentality, which is much appreciated. And you're thinking about accessibility. You're thinking about the comfort of your technology. So that's really appreciated and important to making sure we get an equitable lens in technology, in worker and training, and make it meaningful. I was wondering, maybe you might want to have any kind of closing comment, any kind of closing statement you want to make before we go over to the next speaker.
No, I'm eager for people to learn more about the modules that we've developed, and we are interested in receiving feedback about, whether the modules work for you, if you have advice about how to improve some of the things that we're doing, or if you want to share examples of how you have used or how you're thinking about using the course materials in your own teaching and learning, we really would appreciate feedback, so that we can continue to improve the products that we're developing.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you. So let's get ready for our next speaker. I'd like to take a moment and recognize that next we have the Program in Occupational Health and Safety Education on Emerging Technologies, the Mid-Atlantic Partnership, also called POET MAP. I probably mispronounced that, so I'm going to get corrected later. We're joined by Dr. Ramchandra, a professor and deputy chair in the Department of Environmental Health and Engineering in the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University to discuss the program's efforts to develop web-based educational and training modules. So, Dr. Ramchandra, I turn it over to you.
Thank you, Eric. Let me start sharing my screen. Okay. So thank you very much for this opportunity to talk about Pocket Map. Simple to pronounce. It's the Program on Occupational Health and Safety Education on Emerging Technologies, Mid-Atlantic Partnership. And so we are funded by NIEHS through this R25 grant. As the term Mid-Atlantic suggests, Johns Hopkins University, where I am, is joined by collaborators from University of Maryland, George Mason University, and Old Dominion University. The program's objective is to develop a comprehensive set of web-based educational modules in occupational health and safety, with emphasis on applications in emerging technologies, emerging contaminants, and disaster preparedness. So we have a number of collaborators, some from Johns Hopkins and some from our partner institutions. And these are spread around these different areas in which we are going to be creating these educational modules. So we have detection technologies in which we have Dr. Pete DiCarlo and Dr. Karsten Prasse, who are in the Whiting School of Engineering, but in environmental engineering, environmental health and engineering. We have another module on vulnerable occupational populations, where we have Dr. Leslie M. Kiros-Alcala and Dr. Anna Pollack from George Mason University. We have Dr. Megan Davis and Dr. James Blando from Old Dominion University working on exposure assessment and mitigation. Dr. Amir Sapkota from University of Maryland and Dan Barnett from here on disaster preparedness. And then lastly, Dr. Anna Rule and myself working on sustainable production. And so today, actually, I'm joined by Dr. Anna Rule, who's in the room with me, and she'll be talking about one aspect of our research training in a bit. So our center is sort of organized in this fashion. We have these four areas of emerging technologies that we want to focus on: additive manufacturing, nanobiotechnology, emerging disinfection technologies, and electronic nicotine delivery systems, or e-cigarettes. On the left-hand side, you see these different module cores that we talked about in the previous slide: sustainable production, detection technologies, exposure assessment, disaster preparedness, and vulnerable populations. And we are sort of synthesizing these emerging technologies and using them as examples in these different module cores and create a variety of online products. So we have online modules that these modules will be incorporated into online courses, to degree programs and research experiences, continuing education courses, as well as just-in-time training for public health and other workers for emerging disasters. These products will be disseminated through our Center for Teaching and Learning through their courses, Coursera webinars and mini courses, YouTube, and also in-class content. And our audience for this are not only our own students at our partner institutions and Johns Hopkins University, but also anywhere else, instructors anywhere who want to use and access this content, and sustainability managers who want to look at sustainability issues, EHS professionals, company managers, employees, public health workers, healthcare providers. So the first specific aim is, as I mentioned, we are going to develop five online cores for professional training of occupational health specialists, engineers, scientists, technicians, and instructors. And the areas, again, I'm not going to repeat them again, but these are the five areas in which we'll be developing these online cores. And each core will contain 10 web-based modules, and each module is roughly an hour. And so at the end of our 5 years, we hope to have created 50 one-hour modules that can be accessed by whoever wants to access them. But I also want to point out that these are not one-hour videos, although they can be viewed as that, but they are broken up into smaller segments. So each segment can be as short as a few minutes, maybe 5 minutes, to as much as 15, but no one video is more than 15, 20 minutes long. And so these are stitched together to create these one-hour long modules, and then they are then stitched further up to create longer course content. So the first thing I want to show you is our YouTube channel. And before I go to the actual channel, I want to show some statistics for it. So we have 81 subscribers, and here are the number of videos. Like I said, you know, these are video times range from 10 to 25 minutes. So we have a number of videos in each of these different areas. And we have in total about around 5,700, 5,800 views as of April 26th. So I want to quickly go over to the YouTube channel and show you that. And hopefully you all can see this. And so we have the pocket map. And you know, as you can see, I have subscribed to it too. So so this is how the page appears to you. So we have these modules on exposure assessment, and there's quite a few of them around here. Oh, sorry, I did not mean to do that. Hold on, this will come back. Okay. And detection technologies, disaster preparedness and risk management, and vulnerable worker populations. I wanted to share a couple of videos just to give you a flavor of how these look like. And so this is one on by one of our members, Dr. Carsten Prasse, on targeted and untargeted analysis. And I'll just play a brief segment from it just to give you a flavor.
One way and how I like to envision this is kind of thinking about walking down a street at night.
So that was the first video I want to share. And a second one. This is on. So that was on Monte Carlo uncertainty analysis. So our modules span the range of content from sort of targeting chemists as well as exposure assessors. But these this content is actually accessible by the goal is to have them accessible by graduate students, but also by professionals in the field. So let me get back to my presentation. I'm going to skip this slide since I just showed it to you. Okay. Our second specific aim is to use these modules in online course. First goal is to enrich our existing occupational health and safety curricula by offering blended learning courses that emphasize the applications of OHS principles to the study of emerging technologies. And then I'll talk about this next. And then I'll also talk about our development of a new online master's program in product stewardship and our progress towards that goal, and how we are using or planning to use some of these modules for training, just-in-time training for disaster preparedness for frontline workers. And then finally, how do we create continuing education courses for professionals and instructors in OHS applicable to emerging technologies. So in terms of enriching our existing curricula, I'm just giving you an example from Johns Hopkins before I move to other universities. So we are incorporating these materials into our existing courses at our school in our department. So we have a course that I teach called Exposure Assessment Techniques for Health Risk Management. There is a course that Dr. Leslie M. Quiros Alcala teaches on health of vulnerable worker populations. And then there's a third course on total worker health that is taught by Dr. Megan Davis. So if you just sort of click on one of them, hope this works. We can go here, and if you just look at the content, let's see, and look at, let's say, lecture three, and you can see a bunch of reading materials, but also you can see on the right-hand side these videos. So these are the videos that were created as part of Pocket Map. And I'm not going to play them right now, but you know, these are exactly the same things that we have on our YouTube site as well. So you see the, you know, these are two sub-modules. So they are, you know, 7 minutes and 13 seconds and 16 minutes. So they are much less than 1 hour in length, but that's the idea, that we can, you know, stitch together entire lectures using these modules. So now moving to one of our partners, Old Dominion University. Our partner Jim Blando is actually going to Kyrgyzstan very soon as part of his Fulbright specialist project to work with the International School of Medicine there, as well as the Ministry of Health, and will be demonstrating the utility of Pocket Map for their missions and to encourage the use of these modules and incorporate them in their programs. Within Old Dominion University itself, these modules are used in one of their courses on environmental and occupational risk assessment. And then there is this picture on the right-hand side. You see one of the students, an undergraduate student and an MPH student who are involved in development and of these modules and looking at noise surveys among firefighters. So these are eventually being, and we don't have that module completely ready yet, but it's being processed right now. The next goal is to create a master's program in product stewardship. Product stewardship is basically defined as the responsible management of health, safety, and environmental aspects of the production of anything, from the raw material stage to their final finished product, and then eventually its recycling and disposal. And basically, the idea is that a company manages its products from their inception to disposal, cradle to grave management of these materials. And as you can see, it sort of includes everything from sustainable product design and development, product safety testing, exposure and risk assessment, awareness of safety regulations, recycling and take back, hazardous and banned substance management, safety data sheets, transportation, everything. And in fact, the American Industrial Hygiene Association for a while had its a whole day of its conference devoted to product stewardship. This eventually spun off, and there is now a product stewardship society. And so we felt like there is a market here for creating a master's program here. But we started off small. We said, let's start off with a certificate program. So this is an entirely online 18 credit. So these are 18 quarter credits, not a semester credit, 18 credits program designed for people in the corporate sector, junior, mid-level, or even executive level professionals who are non-degree seeking students. They would get a certificate at the end of this program. And we expect that people who are taking this would have backgrounds in environmental health, regulatory compliance, industrial hygiene, OHS, sustainability, the list goes on. It's also, of course, open to our master's and doctoral degree students. Very briefly, program requirements are the second set of courses here. There's Intro to Risk Sciences, and there's a course on energy and environment that looks at life cycle analysis. Designing for Sustainability looks at sustainability, industrial processes, and pollution prevention. And then there's a bunch of environmental health law and toxicology courses. So that's our sort of startup, but we are eventually thinking there'll be a master's program. And so here's our thinking around that, that there'll be courses on toxicology, environmental chemistry, exposure assessment. That's the course I talked to you, which already exists, for which we have used pocket map modules, risk assessment, sustainability, product safety testing, and so on. There are also courses on environmental law, regulatory tax, and economics, public policy, and so on. And so you can see on the right-hand side, so there is like technical competency rubrics, regulatory competency, and professional competency rubrics that we need to meet. And then there's a bunch of electives as well. We are also, as some of you may know, Johns Hopkins also is the home for a NIOSH-funded education and research center, ERC, that is funded by NIOSH. In addition to training graduate students in occupational safety and health, we also have a continuing education program. So we have been working with the ERC for creating modules that target a whole range of occupations, physicians, physician assistants, nurses, nurse practitioners, industrial hygienists, safety professionals, and so on. Again, it's a sort of very easy process for us to disseminate the modules through our ERC. Lastly, in specific aim two, we are also reaching out to vulnerable worker populations, and that's one of the courses that we offer. So this is one example that I wanted to highlight that is being led by Dr. Leslie M. Quiros Alcala. She is a faculty member in our department, a member of the faculty member in the ERC, and also a partner in the Pocket Map R25. And so this is a outreach she had to a hairdressing salon, one of many. Katrina Randolph, you see in the top picture, is a member of the Health Advocates InReach and Research. It's a program that engages barbershops in Baltimore City. And so she was recruited for a study on chemical exposures by Leslie M. that measures levels of chemicals in the air and also in the stylist's urine. Rather than talk about this myself, I want to show you a quick video.
Health was my driving passion to help others, but also rich on history.
Fortunately, the audio is not coming through.
Oh, it's not? Okay. Okay, let's stop that then. Basically, what the audio says is that women have greater exposures to these chemicals used in hair products, and women of color use more types and greater quantities of these hair care products. They may be at a higher risk than others. And so what Leslie M is working on is looking at these exposures of these hairdressers. And this is again a nice synergy between our pocket map where these modules are being created and the ERC that provided pilot funding for her. And then now she has recently been awarded a NIH grant to look at an R01 grant to look at these exposures. And lastly, here are some of the modules that have been created for disaster preparedness and risk management. And we are, Dr. Dan Barnett has been in touch with the Maryland Department of Health, as well as the City of Baltimore, to further disseminate these modules to the employees in those agencies. And lastly, I want to talk about specific aim 3, which is about creating lab and field-based research experiences for our students in OHS relating to emerging technologies. So the first one is actually on ethylene oxide monitoring, and this was led by Dr. Pete DiCarlo. Ethylene oxide is a hazardous air pollutant, and it's primarily used for sterilization of medical devices in the U.S., as well as spice and tree nut fumigation in the ag sector. It's a chemical feedstock for a variety of other chemicals as well. More recently, let me just pull back. So there is according to the IRIS, EPA IRIS system, there's a 1 in 10,000 cancer risk for a lifetime exposure of 11 parts per trillion by volume. And that part per trillion becomes important in a second. And EPA has come out with new rules for facilities using or producing ethylene oxide. So this is a very topical issue. And so this is a research activity that sort of targets this very topical chemical, but also you trains students in the use of advanced technologies. And in this case, it's called the cavity ring down spectroscopy. And this is a method for detecting chemicals at very, very low concentrations. As we all know, light is absorbed at specific frequencies specific to each chemical molecule. But the greater the distance that the light travels through a sample, the greater is its the absorption of light. And so if you have a very low concentration, very few molecules, you really need the light to travel a long distance through this environment. And so the ring down spectroscopy achieves that by basically creating a cavity in which the light sort of reflects back and forth many, many times. So 45,000 feet or 8.5 miles. And this long path length results in parts per billion sensitivity. So this is a picture of the setup. This study did was to look at two different labs, one in which ethylene oxide was being used for sterilization and a different lab in which that did not happen. So it's sort of a control environment. So here are the results from it. So laboratory one, which is where the sterilization was happening, the measurements were of the order of 65 parts per trillion. And laboratory two, where which is the control, the levels were around 1 part per trillion. And so this shows that the instrument that we are using, it is able to detect concentrations at that low level and is able to detect differences at those levels. A number of our graduate students were involved in this field trial. It was in-house And it was a nice exercise for our students in different labs, as well as Dr. Pete DiCarlo's students themselves. A second research experience is looking at the treatment of PFAS in groundwater. And so this was led by Dr. Karsten Prasse's lab. And the paper was published based on that. So Stephen Chow is a postdoc in our department in Dr. Karsten Prasse's lab. And so what this is showing is treatment of PFAS contaminated groundwater. So the team basically took these groundwater in holding tanks and passed them through different columns. One with granular activated carbon, GAC, the other one with anion exchange resin. And so what is being plotted on the x-axis are bed volumes, or how many months of treatment is needed. So 150 bed volumes, roughly 15 months. And so, and what is being shown are the fraction remaining in the treated water. So if there is breakthrough through the columns. So what we're seeing is, and there are like these different chain lengths. And so what we're seeing is for both GAC and the anion exchange, shorter chain compounds are breaking through quicker than longer chain ones. For perfluorinated carboxylic acids. And the bottom two graphs show that for perfluorinated sulfonic acids, the anion exchange resins actually don't break through as easily. So much superior in that way. And so this is an example, where our students are involved in research that is directly relevant to PocketMap. They are engaged in creating modules for PocketMap. A third research experience looks at peroxyacetic acid exposures in healthcare workers. So in healthcare settings, a number of disinfectants are used, but we are focused on peroxyacetic acid or peracetic acid. It typically is in combination with, found in combination with hydrogen peroxide and acetic acid. It's typically used in diluted form. And in this particular case, we use dilution about actually 5%, not 0.5%. The health effects include skin irritation, eye irritation, upper respiratory irritation, and so on. It's actually quite commonly used in the Johns Hopkins hospitals. There have been a number of complaints about it among the janitorial staff about the use of this particular compound. And so we did a study looking at sampling them and also looking at the evaporation rate of peroxyacetic acid. So we used a monitor that's, it's an electrochemical sensor called SafeSide, and 0 to 3 parts per million. So we did a modeling study in an exporter chamber where one of our graduate students, Ryan Hines, shown here, wearing a mask and everything. And we basically mimicked typical cleaning tasks that healthcare workers do. So they are cleaning surfaces, like shown here in the top right, and then cleaning walls, mopping floors. And we have a chamber here which is capable of a wide range of air changes per hour. So it actually goes up to 20 air changes per hour. But we tested this. These experiments were done in 2 to 8 air changes per hour. And we have Ryan wearing this ChemDAC monitor on his lapel. And so I'm going to show you some results. So actually, before I do that, so we used a well-mixed room model, so we have the airflow through the chamber, which is denoted by Q, the generation rate, depending on each step, each wipe. So that's a function of time, the G. And what we wanted to find out was this KL, which is the evaporation rate, the evaporation rate of peroxyacetic acid, and V is the volume of the chamber. Before we get to that, I just want to quickly point out that the ACGI short-term exposure limit is 0.4 parts per million. And as you can see here, within a few minutes, you don't even have to wait 15 minutes. Within a few minutes, the short-term exposure limit is exceeded, and it goes well beyond the STEL. Ryan then determined the evaporation rate constant, which is K here in inverse minutes. And we can see that the surface roughness, different surfaces were tested, different wind speeds, and different ventilation did not really make a whole lot of difference to the evaporation rate constant. Again, compared a model to the measurements, and so the solid line is our model prediction compared to the three blue dotted lines. These are the measurements, and the these light pink envelopes, these are the upper and lower confidence intervals for the model predictions. So the model, it sort of performs reasonably well for different air changes per hour. For my last research experience, I'm going to pass over the screen to my colleague, Dr. Anna Rule, who led this portion of the study.
Thank you. How much time do you have? Not a lot, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Unfortunately, we only have about a minute or two.
Right. So I'll breeze through this. But so as I think most people know, these electronic cigarettes are just flooding the market. It has been a huge struggle to kind of playing whack-a-mole with FDA trying to regulate, and then another thing coming up in the market. There's many chemicals of concern found in electronic cigarette aerosols, and we had one of our postdocs actually do a really interesting study with Dr. Prasse on non-targeted analysis, and found a lot of, I think, up to 2,000 compounds. But most of my research is on metals of the electronic cigarettes, so that's what I'm going to focus on for now, although this paper is on the big landscape of non-chemical, non-targeted analysis. And the reason we focus on metals is because the coil that heats up the liquid to generate the aerosol is metal. And so we have found, and this is another one of my postdocs, Dr. Herrera, she found metals in aerosols by device type. All of the devices that we test contain metals. As you can see, there's a large variability between the metals, and some of the metals in higher concentrations in some of the types of devices than others. And concerningly, the new devices that are the disposable electronic cigarettes, we're finding that have higher zinc and cobalt, for example. There was another project looking at arsenic in the different devices led by Dr. Charani again. And then one of our doctoral students is leading the charge with looking at the metals in some of the biospecimens. We're collecting urine, saliva, exhale, breath, condensate, and blood from participants that bring their devices, and we collect the device aerosols. So that's all I have.
Thank you, Anna. I'll stop sharing, and we are happy to take questions.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Ram and guests for giving us the time to really go in depth, and we appreciate all those tools and resources that you shared, and taking the time to make sure that the audience is able to access them. For those in the audience, if you have questions, once again, you know, please put them in the chat or in the Q&A function. While we are waiting for some questions maybe to roll in, I'm wondering, are you guys collaborating with other R25s?
Yes. It's funny you should mention. So our previous presenter, the Interact. So we have been collaborating with Interact, and especially around issues on additive manufacturing. And our plan is that some of the modules we are going to co-brand. So they'll be both branded as Interact as well as PocketMap. We can share content and reach broader audiences that way. There is already one module that we are sort of that has been produced by Interact that we are thinking that we will also disseminate through our channels. And so we are just still working through the what do you call it, copyright logistics. I mean, these are all like what do you call it, common license, or I'm forgetting what the terminology is. But anyway, they're all common license, but we are sort of waiting for University of Minnesota to sort of give us formal permission for that. So
No, I
we are planning
appreciate
to
that.
continue that, and we'll share, of course, our modules with Interact. So.
Okay, thank you. And I'm just wondering about the status of that MS program in sustainability. Do you have anything about that?
Yeah, so it's so what happens is so even for our certificate program, it's we cannot just create a certificate and put it online or whatever. It has to be approved by the Maryland Higher Education Commission. So, and that's a whole process in itself. So we got the certificate, we got permission for that, and so we are. So finally, it's on the books, and we are waiting for our students, but we are not waiting for it to be proven to be success before we go on to the master's. There, we are already starting the planning for the master's. We have the curriculum almost ready, and we just need to do the application to the Maryland Higher Education Commission again for that. So I think by next year, around this time, I think we should be ready, fingers crossed.
I'm very excited about that. And when you did bring up environmental justice and making sure things are equitable, and you have such a wide audience and such a technical piece of information, I'm wondering, how have you disseminated this training? How have you maybe advertised it to other universities or the public? And if you could share anything about that.
Yeah, so till now our main venues have been through our own courses. So we are offering courses for our own students on the health of vulnerable populations, as well as through our YouTube channel, and through our investigators on PocketMap, their own sort of individual outreach and activities. We also have another NIEHS-funded project. It's a P30 grant, and maybe Anna, you can talk a little bit about the CHARM initiative.
Yeah, well, it's a P30 with a focus on community environmental health. And so through that, a lot of the same faculty interact with both centers. And so yeah, that's another avenue where we have a lot of community participation and interaction with community members. And so we're trying to also get some of these modules into high schools and through our students to kind of like go down the pipe.
Great. And one of our participants had some technical questions. For example, on slide 6, you were talking about fundamentals, the follow for non-target and uncertainty analysis. I'm wondering, what are the fundamentals that you follow for that non-target and uncertainty analysis? And if you could also maybe tell us about why you selected a plug flow conceptual model instead of a continuous flow model.
Okay, so the targeted and non-targeted analysis, I'm not an expert on that, but I don't know, Anna, if you want to talk about that.
Dr. Prasi?
Dr. Prasi, I can forward that. And also, these modules are available on YouTube. So, you know, those are accessible to everybody. And that's one of the, you know, the links that I've sent you so that can be shared with everybody. And they can explore those. So there's not just one module that I just showed very briefly. It's the 20-second clip. There are actually a whole bunch of modules on targeted and non-targeted analysis there. What was the other question, second question you asked? Oh, for the why not? So the plug flow model. So what we, so the Valmix room model has been so, you know, in use in indoor air modeling for quite a long time. And it is mathematically sort of amenable to add very different types of generation patterns. So you could have a steady sort of constant generation or sort of different. And so in this case, the generation pattern is dependent on the person doing the wiping. So if you have one layer, one sort of wipe action, then, you know, there's stuff, you know, evaporating from the surface. Then you have a second wipe coming on top. Then you have a second layer. And so, you know, the model, mathematically, it makes it sort of tractable to deal with such a complex situation. So that's the main reason we chose that particular framework.
Yeah, thank you for clarifying for us. And one more question before we start wrapping it up. You know, will the trainees conducting the lab experiences then train other trainees and what they learned?
Oh, absolutely. So I showed you one example of Ryan Hines doing that work on the peroxyacetic acid. So he is now, in fact, developed a module on using modeling as well as chamber studies to develop exposure, I mean, sorry, emission rates for volatile substances. And so that is going to be a training module that we'll add to our Pocket Map YouTube site. And that's just an example. So we have a bunch of other doctoral students doing similar activities. So they are going to be doing exactly what you're saying, which is create more modules. And
and if I may add, like for example, on the electronic cigarette project, we have the postdoc training the doctoral students so that they can, two of them are doing their doctoral dissertations on it. And we have three master students that are helping recruit and helping collect the data and helping. So definitely the different generations. And it's really cool to see the postdoc mentoring and then the doctoral student getting a little mentoring also for the master students.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for answering all those questions and, you know, laying out all that information. Once again, making these tangible with tools and resources, and those web links are provided throughout the chat for those the audience members to look to. So thank you again, and we're actually going to head on now to our last speaker. So
thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. So last for today, we will hear from Dr. Stuart Batterman, a professor of environmental health sciences and global public health at the University of Michigan School of Public Health, and professor of civil and environmental engineering in the College of Engineering. He is joined by Dr. Kermit Davis, professor at the University of Cincinnati. They will discuss work being done via the Michigan-Ohio Occupational Research Education, or MORE, program. Since there always seems to be more, what can be done in the name of occupational training and education? So that's quite a fitting name, and I'm glad to hear from both of you all, and please feel free to get started.
Thanks, Eric. Let me share my screen. I can. Do you see that?
Yes,
I can.
Okay, fantastic. Well, happy to be here to talk about our MORE program, which is the Michigan-Ohio Occupational Research Education Program. And I'm Stuart Batterman here with Kermit Davis, who's professor and section chief in Cincinnati. You can see the affiliations there. So to get some of the program details out of the way, they're listed on this slide. Small print, I don't want to spend too much time on this. And I'll go to the overall goals of the program. Like the other two presenters who laid a lot of the groundwork for me as a third speaker today, our goal is to develop and deliver training and research experiences for graduate students and professionals to advance skills in OHS. And we're interested in exposure assessment specifically applied to aerosols, indoor air quality, ventilation, filtration, ergonomics, and in particular in underserved and at-risk communities. And this involves EJ communities, home health care, other low-wage and disadvantaged populations. And we'll be giving a couple of examples of some of the products to date from the MOR in this presentation. The organization is depicted here, U of M, University of Cincinnati, Michigan State are the three universities involved. Our goals are to develop courses for skill development, to work on curriculum and methods development, and to provide research experiences. And like the other presenters, our target audiences include both graduate students and practitioners. And we also have some undergrads involved as well. The individuals involved at the three universities are shown here. In the interest of time, I won't go through them, but we have a very good collection of individuals. Individuals with asterisks have either been added or have left since program inception, although we remain in contact and call on them to help with various activities. I also note that we do have a Wikipedia involved in this, and we are gearing up to utilize that as well. So in brief, some of the products and outcomes are listed on this slide. I think you heard Dr. Jones talk about her instructional development team, and we developed a best practices guide for online course development. We're using an approach which has been fine-tuned here at U of M in our Coursera activities, which we have been engaged on for probably almost 10 years now. And this uses an evidence-based backward curriculum design, basically starting off with the goals that you want and then determining the effective approaches to develop the content as well as the design and the production and so forth. And a timeline is shown on the right here. And this approach, I think, is amenable for everybody. So we hope to get this finalized and then disseminated, though we've been using it, as I said, for a number of years. We offer lessons, courses, webinars, and modules. Some of the topics include aerosols and virus exposure assessment in buildings, building controls, ventilation assessment, and complex exposures in home healthcare environments. We conducted a research camp, and we'll show you a few highlights from that. There are a number of challenges and implications from our experience on this research camp, and Dr. Davis will talk a little bit more about that in just a minute. But I'll raise some of the issues in getting different universities and students at different universities to coordinate is something that is a challenge, but it's very rewarding when we make it happen. It's also very interesting to get students involved in field and lab research, as you've heard from previous speakers here, as well, to generate new hypotheses, new collaborations, and ultimately really critical thinking skills. So there's a lot of benefits to it, and a lot of questions and logistics and recruitment. And so, but still it's been quite a learning experience for us. So I'm gonna turn it over to Dr. Davis to talk about course development.
So yeah, we started off this year, or actually last year, where we developed a course in home healthcare, and we did a multidisciplinary team that included industrial hygiene, risk assessment, occupational nursing. Initially, it was developed as a class course, and then we're now converting it into a continuing education course. The whole focus was to reach out to our students for the class course and then expand that out to our reach to home healthcare workers and supervisors for home healthcare workers to really expand the reach of it through the continuing education focus. We focused it on the complex exposures of home healthcare. What's really interesting is the uniqueness of exposures that you get in home healthcare that you don't get in any other healthcare industry. As Stuart said earlier, this is a population that is underrepresented and oftentimes low wage. And it's also one of the most unique industries in the sense that every home is unique and different. So every workplace that you go into, and you're going into multiple ones each day, is unique and different. It's not like you walk into a manufacturing facility and you show up to the line where you're at and you do the same thing day in, day out. You're going into unique environments and multiple ones during the day, throughout the day, and throughout the week. The goals of the course was to address key and complex exposures that we have identified over the last 7 to 8 years of research, and looking at how the complex exposures oftentimes interact. And we'll be talking about that a little bit in our summer camp research project. But we looked at learning outcomes of describing complex exposures for home healthcare, measuring internal doses and responses, identify administrative and engineering controls for prevention, and do several case studies to talk about how to mitigate risks. There were 6 modules. I'm not going to go over them in detail, but as you can see them here, this is a 6 module online course that is now being converted to continuing education. For our research camp that we had, we designed for over the summer. It brought the researchers from Michigan down to the University of Cincinnati, where we had an aerosol chamber where we could simulate exposures to secondhand smoke. For home healthcare workers, this is a very unique exposure. They actually have secondhand smoke exposure that is more than for the primary smokers of home healthcare workers. Secondhand smoke is actually a higher risk factor than their primary smoking. Exposure is oftentimes a much higher level in duration and exposure. And why is that? Because you can smoke in your own home. And so when you go into these different homes, the caregivers, non-professional caregivers, and the patients can often smoke in their homes, and they can do it continuously for the 1, 2, 3 hours of the time that the caregiver or the home health care nurse or nurse's aide is in the home. So we actually investigated the exposures to the caregivers and nurses, particularly looking at how the source of the smoke is impacting the levels. So it could be on the left or right side of the bed or the patient in the bed. We also looked at how caregiver or the nurse's posture it impacts the exposure, either bent over or upright. And then we also looked at 3 different purifier type of exposures, with a small one, a large one, and none at all. We were trying to see if this would be an actual intervention that we can implement for caregivers to reduce the exposures for home healthcare aides and nurses to the secondhand smoke. And the next one kind of gives us a picture of the team that up to the left is the team of students that conducted the research. As you see, we simulated in the actual chamber where you have many instrumentations that we looked at for various different types of sampling to give the PhD trainees a wide experience of this. And actually, several of these students that are in the picture were first years that were just starting into our program that got exposed into this and thrown into some of this exposure with well-seasoned also in some of the faculty. And as you can see, we were able to use mannequins to reduce exposures for having an actual individual in the room. And we put them in different positions so that mannequin can be bent over and more upright. That really changes the exposures. And then the purifiers were at the end of the bed towards where we were at the screen. And then we just went through a rigorous multiple exposures of both cigarette smoke as well as assaults. Aerosol to look at the differences on exposures that the individuals would have at different positions. This just gives you a kind of a just a sliver of some of the data that we collected. We're now in the process of having these trainees go through and put publications together. We expect three different publications that all the trainees that were involved will be participating in, but each of them, or a group of them, are each being leading a separate publication. But you can really see, and that just that we can really, that there are differences in the positions and the purifiers. But if you look at, there's team one that's looking at the effects of the air purifiers on personal exposure to the caregivers. And so looking at, the secondhand smoke distribution, looking at different particles, team two is looking at the effect of caregiver posture. So as the patient or the caregiver is bent over to upright, how does those changes are impacted? And then the third team is looking at how air purifiers impact the particular matter exposure and spatial distribution around the home. And looking at the directional airflows. The other interesting thing that you have in a home environment with aerosols is the airflow is much different than the ventilation that you have in hospitals or long-term care facilities. So it's much poorer. And so this chamber has allowed us to able to simulate that to see how these distributions of particles from smoking can really change the exposures for home healthcare workers. I think that's my slides.
Okay, and just to show a little bit of the data, we did, I think, something on the order of 40 some simulations in this chamber over a week or so. And you can see a smoking event and then a decay. And that decay can be matched to an exponential, and Dr. Ramachandran presented a box model for this. And of course, that's one way to get out an exponential decay and to determine the particle lifetime as well as the air change rate if you're using tracer gas like CO2. So we ended up with hundreds of these because each instrument generated this kind of data from nanoparticles to about 10 micron or 30 micron diameter particles. So tremendous amount of data. So students also got a lot of experience in data sets and data management and so forth. Some of this activity is being leveraged with other work and feeding into other work that's dealing with teacher exposure. And just as Kermit mentioned, every home is unique. Every school is also unique. And teachers and children, of course, in schools are there is 8 hours, 6 to 8 hours a day. It's one of the most important compartments for exposure outside the home. And so we have been developing a set of tools to help assess ventilation and particle clearance in schools. And these are just some slides that come from some of the presentations and modules that are that have been developed that are now being translated into more plain language activities for these affected communities. And in particular, we're looking at environmental justice communities where buildings are typically naturally ventilated, and the role of exposures can be very important for them. So I don't have time to go through all the details here, but just to show, you know, that we do have targets for what we would like to see in terms of ventilation. We explain how ventilation works. And again, building from what Ram had shown here, you have different pathways for air ventilation coming into the building, both being forced by a mechanical system as well as infiltration through doors and windows. And of course, in naturally ventilated buildings, which tend to be older and very common in inner city areas or urban areas that are more impoverished, the building stock is deficient, we find that air change rates are very, very low. So drawing on some prior research, just to highlight how low, even in the newest buildings, the median air change rates are on the order of 1 to 2. And with COVID now, we're asking for about 3 to 6. And so in naturally ventilated buildings, it's even lower. There's not a good database on this, but we're finding levels typically around 1. And so part of our outreach and our program here is to reach this community of facility managers and professionals involved in buildings, and in particular schools, to get them aware of this problem and to deal with this problem. The other part of building systems, which is easily, it's a low-hanging fruit really, is to utilize effective filters to reduce PM levels and particulate matter levels, as well as aerosols that might be have virus particles on them. And we know a lot how to use these types of filters. And again, we've been developing modules to explain the different types of filters that folks can use and other aspects of maintaining these filters and making them effective. In naturally ventilated buildings, we don't have the opportunity to use the mechanical system, so it's really a standalone filter, as shown on the left, which can provide a some relief. And again, a lot's known about filters, and in the interest of time, I won't go through this information, but this remains a major problem. We find lots of issues with bypass, with overloaded filters, or even missing filters in practice. So the same types of curves that were generated in the research camp pretty much are similar in buildings. This is tracking CO2 levels as students come in a naturally ventilated building. Different classrooms are shown here. The dark line is the average, but it's typically well over 1,000 ppm. And then we have a nice smooth decay at the end of the school day as the building purges itself over time. Particulate matter in some of these urban schools can be very similar to outdoor levels. Yet when we install filters in these naturally ventilated buildings, we see, for example, the PM levels outside around 8 or so micrograms per cubic meter is considerably reduced indoors. So this is just demonstrating the effect that filters can work. The next issue is to get people to use them. And my challenge is to get me to use the mouse here, which has just dropped off. So one of the more products that we're soon to release is a spreadsheet tool to look at clearance rates and to estimate air change rates. And this is showing you an early version of this, but we actually also want to port this to an app to allow folks to use it on their phone and basically plug in a minimal amount of data and pull out from that the air change rate, pollutant clearance, and your filter efficiency. there's a number of different mathematical techniques that we can use, and we're going to build in a couple of the options. What I'm showing here is the decay option, which is probably the easiest one to use, but many folks use a steady state option. Another part of an app that we're developing is a model to show the type of effectiveness that would be expected for adding a standalone air filter. These curves are showing you the predicted pollutant reduction for different clean air delivery rates for these filters. The kind of home units that you might buy might be a couple hundred CFM. Larger ones might be up to 500. You could see that, for example, in a naturally ventilated building with, say, an air change rate of one, expected reduction for a, say, 500 CFM air change air delivery rate would be on the order of 70 to 80%. So it's quite good. These results apply to a naturally ventilated typical classroom with 6 or 7,000 cubic feet. This actually works to an extent. In practice, we're showing here observations that were obtained by a team and in a naturally ventilated building. And the dots with the circles are with the filters, and they're somewhat close to some of the predictions that we get. There's a lot of variability between space. There's a lot of factors that need to be controlled with respect to modeling, like is the window open, is the teacher actually using the filter, and so forth. So some of the outreach needs to go directly to the teachers that are involved. So to wrap up here, Moore has produced this research experience or camp that Dr. Davis talked about. We have a CE course, which is going to be offered in the next few months. We have a couple of academic courses that have been developed and delivered. The webinars are also available and being translated and taking a teach the teacher or train the trainee type of approach for reaching, in particular, disadvantaged communities. Should also mention that we are part of the NIOSH-supported Education and Research Center as well, and we've taken our trainees to a number of the research symposium and held most recently on the topic of AI and the future of OSH. And many of these materials are available on our website. The methodologies, the tools, and the apps we hope to get out this summer. And the last thing I'll mention, I think, is the diversity aspect, is that we're also hosting under another grant program, a half a dozen undergrads from minority-serving institutions, and we'll have at least one dedicated student this summer working on more activities. So thank you very much, and that'll wrap up with our contact information here.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Davis and Dr. Batterman. I appreciate that. I appreciate that you guys covered a lot in like the tiniest amount of time. So I appreciate that too. And how you disseminated this and plan to disseminate it to other communities and communities that really need this and the access and opportunity to it. It appears that we have one of our folks, Heather Henry, if she doesn't mind going off mute and asking her question. There might be a bit of a delay. Let me see if I could just ask a question in the meantime as we try to get her unmuted. So Dr. Davis, regarding caregiver exposure to environmental tobacco smoke, do you have a sense of what fraction of patients smoke and how long caregivers spend with patients?
I didn't catch the last part of that.
What fraction of patients smoke and how long caregivers spend with patients?
Yeah, so what we're what we're seeing is about it kind of changes but as more data gets around, but around 18 to 20% of patients we've recently have, and that we've done this, we've collected some data down in Puerto Rico, around we're starting to get expanded around Ohio, but it was about 15% on our studies of people, which I think is pretty good in a lot of sense. A smoking rate, but you know, I think it probably really depends on the United States part of it. You know, certainly different states have different smoking rates, and that would play a pretty dominant rate. So I would say probably 20 to 25% is what we're seeing. And you know, the nice thing is, I guess we're seeing variations throughout the you know the day type of thing, depending on who they're seeing. So.
Yeah, thank you for clearing that up. The next question, you know, if I just get the cold, I can barely move, let alone, you know, really in serious situations. How do, you know, for example, bedridden patients, right? They can't just open windows and clear the air. Do you have suggestions other than filters?
Well, certainly what we've been thinking about is, you know, depending on... And on the outdoor environment is, you know, opening up windows, getting exposure, cross ventilation through there, maybe potentially even fans is something that we're approaching. You know, we were sort of, I want to say, and maybe Stuart can correct me, but I think we were sort of a little bit disappointed that the purifiers didn't respond as beneficial as we thought they were going to when we set the study up, but I would default to I guess Stuart on that one because he's more the aerosol than my background of ergonomics. So, but you know, I think it's a lot of the exposures is you know getting different types of ventilation going and air movement within the home. It will be key. So, I mean, there was some benefits long-term wise with the purifiers. It just was more initial bumps as it pulled the air, you know, past the caregiver was one of the big issues, I guess. Stuart, yeah, do you want to?
Yeah, I'd love to add to that. So this was kind of counterfactual, and I think very interesting for the students to experience this. And depending on the postures, where the smoke source was, where the exhaust for the room was, turning on the air purifier could double or even triple the exposure of the caregiver or the patient. And that's during the smoking event. And it's because of the directional flows, which aren't embodied in that box model that I showed you and that Ram gave the equation for. On the other hand, that would typically clear the smoke out much faster after the exposure, after there was a time for mixing and so forth. On the other hand, if that airflow was in a favorable direction, then the purifier could really bring things down quite quickly. So, like many other things, the answer is it depends. And so the recommendations for an intervention using a filter like this for a caregiver, it's a little complex. It's a little hard to generalize overall. I think the other thing that's very interesting to mention too, and I don't know, Kermit, if you want to talk about the ergonomic issues that are involved as well, because this is really a dual exposure that I think we're looking at here.
Yeah, so one of the things that obviously the bent postures really do influence exposures from the caregivers, what you're exposed to aerosol wise in an upright posture is very different than you get in the physical side when you bend over. And then you throw in, you know, moving patients around, which you're by yourself, and the heavy exertions could cause you to breathe more rapidly. So we have actually some studies going on to look at how physical exertion posture actually is changing the actual intake of smoke or, you know, just air because of the different ergonomics postures. So, it is this real combination of high physical, poor postures that really impacts the exposure of the caregiver in these environments that have smoke all around them. So,
yeah, thank you for one tag teaming that response. So you get two perspectives there. That was really intriguing. Dr. Badman, I see that you're responding to a question in the Q&A. I don't know if you want to respond to it maybe on live.
Or... Alexa says, "What are we going to do?" I'm going.
Yeah. So the question is, what about non-steady state cases? And we can't expect steady state cases when concentration CO2 and temperature change over time. And that's absolutely true. I think one of the mistakes that a lot of folks have made when they're looking at, for example, CO2 as an indicator of ventilation is to assume steady state conditions. And generally, that's hard to maintain when occupancy is dynamic, for example, or, you know, in the case of classrooms, kids come in and then they go out. This is not a steady state condition. If the ventilation system is changing in response to heat loads and things like this, again, that's not steady state. So some of that can be handled with the model, but I think a better assumption is not to assume that it's steady state.
Spoken like a true scientist. So last question, Dr. Madman. Are schools in environmental justice areas more at risk for ventilation and air quality deficiencies? Are school administrations and faculty managers proactive in addressing ventilation and air quality and using higher quality filters?
Right, great question. So over the past couple of years with the epidemic, approximately a quarter of the schools have deployed, let's call them HEPA air purifiers. And this was provided to them for free. And it was done in the hope that this would reduce infectious risk. We don't have a large enough sample size to really evaluate the effectiveness of this program. There was no program evaluation provided in this many $100 million program from the federal government. We see quite mixed results. Many times now, a couple of years after the filters were distributed, we find that they're not being used. And in most cases, we find that the filters have not been replaced. So the systems, if they're being used, they're being used on the lowest flow. And that can still help, but in many cases, they're just not being used. They're just gathering dust. Is this a problem in EJ areas? Sort of by definition, EJ areas do have higher levels of ambient air pollutants. And we've seen this in a number of different cases. And this is because these tend to be very urban schools, often at the industrial periphery or in a very mixed commercial environments with a lot of truck traffic and so forth. For buildings that are mechanically ventilated, the industry norm remains a MERV 8 filter, which doesn't really remove much PM 2.5 at all, and it's not rated for 2.5. And I quickly showed some pictures of installations of filters and bypass. So my impression is that it is worse in many EJ areas. However, maintenance of building systems and the overall public and private infrastructure for schools and child-serving institutions like daycares and so forth, ventilation and particle removal is a pretty low priority for folks managing these facilities. So I think there's a lot that can be done there to reduce exposure and improve ventilation. And many studies have shown benefits in school performance and school and teacher and kid health for doing so.
Yeah, thank you. And clearly there's a lot more work to be done, and we're thankful that you two are leading the charge in it. So I thank both of you, and I want to make sure that we turn it back over to Dylan to help with the wrap up.
So much, Eric, and thank you so much to our presenters. Okay, let me just share my screen. Perfect. Okay, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. And just before we conclude, let's take a look back at the seminar homepage, as this website will be active from today on and contains important resources such as links to download our presentation materials, any contact information for our speakers should you not have been able to ask your question during today's session, for example, as well as a link to our feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form, as the comments help to improve the content and flow of these webinars in the future. And you also on the webinar homepage can request a certificate email that would validate your attendance for today's session. And also, here are a variety of links to learn more about the Superfund research program. I encourage you to check out the various components of the website to learn more about the program, as well as the initiative presented to you today. I would also like to remind our participants of the various ways to stay connected so that you don't miss any future webinars. For more information on EPA's CLUIN webinars, please refer to the cluin.org website, and you can also subscribe to their monthly newsletter, Tech Direct. We encourage you to also visit the SRP Progress in Research webpage, check out the monthly research brief, and subscribe to the Progress in Research listserv for more information about upcoming sessions. And you can also follow SRP on X, formerly Twitter, at SRP_NIEHS. And lastly, I would like to encourage everyone to join us for the third and final session in the webinar series on May 17th. If you are unable to attend live, an archive will be available shortly after the event, as is the case with our first session that we were able to have last Friday, April 26th. And with that, it is time to conclude today's session. Thank you all so much for your participation, and thank you to our presenters for their time spent preparing and sharing their presentations with us today. I hope everybody has a lovely Friday and weekend to follow.